Critics Advice D&D. Movies, video games, RPGs. Finding it's easy, just stay calm. VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by NobleKnightGames.com. Your source for out-of-print and new game products. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Greetings, this is Jim Ryan of the Great Debate RPG Podcast, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 124. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, Mike Shea and I are going to build a foul-spawn encounter guarding a Fae Gate and talk about collaborative storytelling. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, the listeners need to know ahead of time that I am unprepared this episode and don't have most of my intro and outro stuff scripted as well as I usually do. So this is Tome Unscripted. And I'm going to lean heavily on my 3 years of experience and hope that I don't forget something important. But if I do, I'll apologize now, and I don't need the hate mail. So, Mike, we're going to build an encounter today, and we're going to talk about collaborative storytelling. But before I do a lot of those things, I usually like to talk to our guests a little bit and figure out who you are and what you've been doing and where people can find you and all the neat projects that you've been up to. So who is Mike Shea?
Great. Let's see. Who is Mike Shea? I'm a 36-year-old D&D player who's been playing and running games since I was a kid. I started with 2nd edition. And lately I've been very heavily into D&D 4th edition. We started right when Keep of the Shadowfell came out and have been playing pretty much weekly up until now. So our main PCs have gone from level 1 to level 21. We just entered the epic tier. And 4th edition has really been the edition of D&D that I've enjoyed the most, and I feel like gives me all the tools as a DM that I need to be able to really tell the story that I want to tell. I run a couple of different D&D-related websites. Probably my primary site is slyflourish.com, where I focus on trying to help 4th edition dungeon masters get better, including myself. And I also run a daily DM tip on Twitter. That's twitter.com/slyflourish.
And I find that one of the things I deal with on Twitter is that I have a lot of people that I follow, and oftentimes I just sort of skim through everything and I don't really read most of the posts, you know, and then there's a few things here and there. I always say, oh, that person usually has something interesting to say, and I make sure to read it. And the Sly Flourish Twitter is one of the ones I almost always read whenever I see it. So it is good advice, and usually, even if it's not something I know, it's at least something that makes me think about my gaming again, you know, or remember that, or think about that topic again and say, okay, am I doing that kind of thing?
Right. That's exactly the purpose, to help get me to think, as well.
Yeah. So you find doing Sly Flourish also helps you improve your game?
Oh, that's why I do it. You know, I mean, I want to kind of meet people and talk to other folks that are running this stuff. But my real intent is to try to get to be a better dungeon master myself. And I figure the best way to do that is to talk about it.
Very cool. So any other projects you're working on, or does that pretty much handle it?
There's one, if I could throw out another one. I've just started a 4th edition blog aggregation site called 4eblogs.com. That's an automated system for tracking all of the 4th edition blogs on the internet and putting it in one place with one RSS feed. And it also publishes those headlines to Twitter, twitter.com/4eblogs.
Very, very cool. How did I not know about that?
I don't know.
I'm there now. It's looking good.
Yeah. It's a fun little weekend project that I put together.
And you also draw from the RSS from Wizards as well.
Yes, yeah, the Wizards RSS feeds are in there as well.
Very cool. So if you want to catch all of your 4th edition D&D blog-related news or articles, then 4eblogs.com is the place to go.
And the Tome Show is in there as well.
Is it?
Yep.
Wow, go me. It is. Right on. Well, thank you for that.
Sure.
A pleasant surprise. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and break here and talk about our sponsor for the episode, NobleKnight.com. I think I said NobleKnightGames.com before, and I believe both addresses get to the right place. Noble Knight is a brick-and-mortar store, but also has a very good online store as well. And they specialize in selling out-of-date, out-of-print books, games, minis, cards, whatever you're into, they sell all of it, and they specialize in finding the stuff that you usually can't find. So if you're trying to find something difficult to find, or you're trying to get rid of all of your old gaming stuff to make a little extra money at the beginning of this new year, NobleKnight.com will help you out with that. I have a pick of the episode for my Noble Knight sponsor ad here, and it is the Flipmat Arena from Paizo Publishing, a company that I've long enjoyed. And Paizo does these flip mats. Have you seen the flip mats?
I have. Yeah, I love them.
Yeah, they're good. Sort of what poster sized maps of some sort of scene. In this case, I'm looking at the arena.
Yeah,
and it's just, you know, if you ever wanted a coliseum or some sort of arena, it's ironic because I actually started my fourth edition campaign. The very first encounter was in an arena.
Yeah.
And I developed this whole elaborate thing and had it all set up and all that. But it would have been great to have this already done, just lay it out, and there's an arena that looks like an arena, not just my battle mat with overhead markers drawn all over the place.
Right. The one they have that I really love is the boat. They have one that's got two levels of a boat on it, and it's real hard to find a boat anywhere else, you know, without drawing it out yourself.
And so you have the top deck on one side, and you flip it over, and then you've got below
decks. It's got both decks on the same mat. So
that is awesome.
You know, you could say that some people are below and some people are above on one mat.
I had to work pretty hard going through various PDF products to find a boat, because there's a boat that's central in my campaign as well.
Right.
And ended up finding something that I'm getting by on, but I wish I'd have seen that flip map.
And it works for airships, and it works for spelljammers, and it works for anything that would look like a boat. So yeah, that's one I use a lot.
All right, so there's my pick of the episode and Mike's pick of the episode: the Paizo Flip Mat Arena and boat. And I will have those linked in the show notes.
Yeah, one other little cool thing about them is they use both wet and dry erase markers.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah.
Because I have to flip back and forth. I use the wet erase on my maps, and then I use the dry erase on my character sheets and stuff.
Okay. That can get dangerous.
Yeah. I've gone through 3 battle maps in the last year and a half.
Right.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
So let's go ahead and get into our first topic here, which is we're going to build an encounter. And like I did last time when we built an encounter with Chatty DM, I basically pulled from my own campaign and said, okay, as long as we're going to be taking the time to do this, let's make it useful to me personally, because that's really what this is all about, is helping me. my characters or my PCs are going to be running around and collecting various things to build an airship, actually, speaking of boats. They're going to be repairing, I guess, an airship. Right now it's a functional boat, and they want to bring it back to its glory days. And that's sort of my MacGuffin that has them running all over the world. Last time we found – when I worked with Phil from Chatty DM, we figured out how they were going to find the sails. And my idea for having them find some timbers was going to be to send them into the Feywild. And so they need to find a portal and get through that. So at this point, we should probably put out there any of my players who are listening can go ahead and fast forward about 20, 30 minutes and continue from there. So I know several of them listen and mentioned last time that they appreciated the spoiler warning and moved ahead. So we're going to have an encounter at the gate, the portal to the Feywild. And we're going to combine my campaign concept with an encounter that you've sort of been working on for Sly Flourish, correct?
Yeah. I run a series of articles called Monster Optimization with the intent of kind of taking the player optimization trend and focusing it for dungeon masters who want to build really challenging encounters for their players.
Right on. So I've also built the encounter around sort of the same themes that we talked about prior to the show. And how do you want to do this? Do you want should we both sort of talk about what we built and compare, or do you want to go through yours and then I'll go through mine, or do we want to go through mine and you tell me how I messed it up, or how do you want to handle it?
Well, why don't I tell you about the main catalyst in the encounter that I put together. I have a full encounter statted out that I can tell you about.
Absolutely.
But there's really one specific thing that it focuses around that really makes it kind of lethal. And then there's a bunch of side stuff around it that could probably pretty easily change. So if you want, I can tell you what that little main draw is.
Absolutely. Well, why don't you tell us about the encounter you built, and then
sure.
Then I'll talk about the one I built and you can tell me how it sucks.
Sure. So your players are level 11 or 12, is that right?
Right now they're level 11, and because it's the way the current leg of the campaign is set up, they could go one of several directions. So they might be 11 when they get here,
okay.
They might be 12, they could
right.
even be 13, you know.
Right. So I mean, one thing, and you know, the way these monster optimization ideas work is they're really intended to challenge a party. They're really intended when a bunch of players have been having a pretty easy time of it. You want to throw one of these out there to kind of keep them honest and remind them that it can be a pretty dangerous world. So I focused it around the idea that it's going to be a pretty big challenge for people. And depending on the skill of your players, you may need to even tone it down a little bit. But so the main theme for this is focused around foul spawns, in particular two different foul spawns, the foul spawn seer and the foul spawn mangler. The foul spawn seer is a artillery, and the main draw for him in this is that he has an at-will ranged attack that does that has a daze effect that save ends.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of creatures that have daze effects that aren't necessarily really that lethal. But when you mix him with a foul spawn mangler, which is a level 8 skirmisher, the skirmisher has a melee attack that does 4 dagger attacks. Each one is like 1d4 plus 3. And he has two throw attacks, two ranged attacks that are, again, 1d4 plus 3, which aren't so bad, except he does 2d6 extra damage when he has combat advantage, which he would have if the guy is dazed.
Right.
So the real theme here is to try to get your seer to daze guys and get the mangler to go up and eat him up with this continuing combat advantage attack. The neat thing about monster combat advantage attacks, where they gain an extra dice, is unlike a player, there's no limit to the number of times this can occur. So where a player has sneak attack once per round, a foul spawn mangler who hits 4 times gets combat advantage all 4 times and could do an extra 8d6 damage.
Wow.
So, you know, 1d4 plus 3 doesn't look that bad until it becomes, you know, 4d4 plus 12 plus 8d6. So it can get pretty nasty. So that idea of mixing the foul spawn seer with the foul spawn mangler is kind of the core draw for an encounter like this. But then you can kind of flesh out the rest of the encounter. Particularly, the seer and the mangler themselves are not particularly powerful. Particularly, I mean, if your players are level 11 to level 13, then level 8 skirmishers and a level 11 artillery is probably not going to be that big. So you want to throw some real big guys or some you know, lightning rods out there, other major creatures that look like they're the real danger,
mm-hmm.
when in fact the seer and the mangler are the real danger.
Yeah. Now, how do you suggest going about making it making them not seem like the main target.
Well, the encounter I set up, I threw some Foulspawn Hulks in there. Mm-hmm. You know, now a Foulspawn Hulk is a level 12 brute, and they're large, so you're going to have these great big, you know, muscular, no skin, red looking nasty guys out there, and those guys are going to look like the real danger. You know, the little guys that are running around in the back don't look that dangerous. But the Hulk's whole purpose is to just take damage from players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if you only have one of them out there, that one of them, it's going to look like a boss. And, you know, one thing I've learned, you know, watching my players go through battles is the minute there's anything that looks like a boss is the minute that guy just takes a ton of damage and dies fast.
Yeah. Well, so that's what I was going to say, is that if you've got a bunch of Hulks out there to keep him busy, and then one Seer and one Mangler to sort of sneak in there, that doesn't work because they see they see one of them and they realize, we got to take that guy out.
Yeah. If you want this to work, I think you have to have at least two Seers and at least four Manglers. And, you know, even more, if they're higher level, if the encounter is higher level, like, say, a level 14 encounter,
mm-hmm.
you can throw up to six Foulspawn Manglers out there and not use up your entire experience budget. And then each of those six are getting 2 to 4 attacks. So, you know, that's a lot of daggers being thrown around the battlefield.
Yeah. And if you don't mind adding in yet another creature, there's also you could also throw in a Foulspawn Berserker, which is a bit lower level, but a soldier, and intend to sort of just sit there and soak up the damage.
Right. Yeah, they would work. They would work really well.
So
but I think
you could have one Hulk and one Berserker as you know, that way they're different things, sort of throwing them off.
And I don't know, the Manglers actually are trained in stealth, so you can actually have them kind of hide. And you might even want them to hide for the first round or two, mm-hmm. you know, until the players have kind of thrown a lot of their stuff out there and think they have an understanding of the battle, and then all of a sudden they start getting hit with a ton of daggers.
Right.
And the daggers start doing a ton of damage, and then that's going to get their attention.
And once that Mangler, once one Mangler gets one of those rounds where he just tears somebody in half...
Right.
The jig is up, you know?
Yeah.
At that point, they know where the threat is.
Right. So, and then that's when you actually have to have some other protections. You know, one of the things I wrote about in the article, the article's not coming out for a couple of weeks, by the way, so I'll repimp it when it actually comes out.
Sure.
But the one of the things you can do is actually have the Seers up on platforms or, you know, have some other geographical mm-hmm. barrier between them and you know, the party's defenders to ensure that they aren't just immediately killed. In the article, I talk about having like platforms that have some kind of foul spawny, some kind of far realm slime on it, so it's very difficult to climb up in order to get to the Seer. And that way your Seers are somewhat more protected. And then the only thing that protects the Manglers is their number. You know, you might put six of them out there and you know, a couple of them are going to die pretty quick, but you're not going to be able to kill all six that fast.
Yeah. Very cool. So anything else to your encounter before we start picking apart my version of it?
Well, one other thought I had was, you know, I think all good encounters need to have a good environmental effect.
Mm-hmm.
So we could talk more about environmental effects. The one I had kind of picked out was called Chaos Breath. This comes from the new Plane Below book. One of the things I really like about Plane Below is it has a lot of these fantastic terrains in here, and they scale depending on the tier of the party.
Mm-hmm.
Chaos Breath, in fact, doesn't. But what Chaos Breath does is when somebody enters a square that's filled with Chaos Breaths, they're teleported or they're slid 1d4 squares in a random direction and then knocked prone. So that's another good way to kind of keep your Seers protected, would be to use Chaos Breath as some kind of barrier between them.
And so it teleports them randomly?
It'll teleport if a player enters a square. It'll teleport that player 1d4, player or monster. It'll teleport them 1d4 squares randomly.
Okay.
And then I
could see sort of revamping the flavor of that to coincide with my Fae Gate pretty well.
Exactly.
Saying
yeah.
you know it's leaking this Fae mist.
Right.
You know that goes right along with already established tropes like the Misty Step. Right.
Yeah. When you talked about having a portal that sits between, you know, the prime material world and the Feywild, my thought was, well, there's got to be some kind of edge to that portal, and maybe that edge broke, mm-hmm. and the broken edge is actually leading into the far realm
mm-hmm.
and has leaked out, you know, so these foul spawns have kind of crawled their way out of this, mm-hmm. you know, this door sill that's between the Feywild and the other one, that the portal became unstable, and when it became unstable, this kind of stuff spilled forth.
So, and then suddenly this is no longer just a trip to get an item that you kind of want. It adds a little bit more weight to the whole thing, because when this is all said and done, you've got to do something to seal up this portal or close it down or do something.
Right.
Good. Well, my first thought whenever I start building anything, because like we were talking about before the show, I am at heart a storyteller gamer. And so I tend to worry less about mechanics, which is why it's good for me to have people like you on. And I think more about story. And so I was trying to come up with a reason that our foul spawn would be at the Feygate. That actually works really well. That there's even if they didn't come out of that crack, maybe there is that just slight edge of a crack, and it could open to a large enough for things to get through, and they're attracted to that energy or whatever. Mm-hmm. Feels like home. But I built mine obviously a little bit differently, because I didn't know how your optimization was going to play out. But I do have a seer in the mix. I don't have the mangler, so mm-hmm. I missed half of your optimization.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some grues to keep them busy, sort of taking pot shots in the back.
Right.
They're a level 8 controller.
Right.
I've got a couple of berserkers, which are the level 9 soldiers. I've got the seer. And I've got one Hulk to sort of look like the big bad.
Right.
You know? And honestly, you look at the Hulk and he's not that scary. He's got one power, and it's just pound things. You know?
Yeah, right. His power is 150 hit points.
Right. That is exactly what his power is. But, you know, it keeps the – again, that'll keep the party thinking, oh, there's one big guy.
Right.
And they're going to focus on him while the lower-level grues, which, you know, should theoretically fall fairly fast, can sit in the back and continue to do their damage.
Right.
And sort of whittle away at the party.
Right.
And then I thought to put a bit of a twist into the whole thing is that while the party was approaching the encounter, approaching this gate – I thought I would start dropping some hints, some perception checks and that kind of thing, that there's some kind of beast or animal in the area that seems to be on the hunt but isn't hunting them. So that's going to tip them off that there's something else in the area, in fact, two somethings in the area, this animal and what turns out to be the Falsmon. And my idea was that there would be a Fey tiger that had come through the gate and was now hunting the Falsmon. And so as the encounter begins, you know, 2, 3, 4 rounds into the encounter, suddenly this this elite, level 12 elite lurker bursts out of the trees and starts tearing apart everything in its sight.
Right.
Now you've got a three-way encounter.
Right.
And I built the Fey Tiger using the adventure tools from D&D Insider. And I know you had a chance to look at it. I basically just took the Fey, was it Panther?
Right.
That we already have in the Monster Manual, and I upgraded it to an Elite and made it level 12 and gave it a claw attack and changed the pounce a little bit.
Right.
So, there's the encounter I sort of built. I thought about possibly having a rock overhang over, you know, sort of a maybe 20, 30 feet away from where the portal is, which could be where our seer hangs out. But beyond that, that's about where my encounter is at. Any additional things I should be thinking about there?
There's a couple things. I was just actually looking at the flavor text for the foul spawn in the monster manual. And an interesting thing is that foul spawns don't come from the far realm. They are humanoids that have been twisted by the far realm.
So if
you wanted to add a little bit more flavor, they could actually be Eladrin, perhaps, that have been twisted and corrupted by a leak into the far realm.
They're a circle of druids and rangers who were guarding the portal and were corrupted.
Went bad. Yeah.
Very cool.
The other thing is, you know, for that overhang, for that rock overhang that the seer is on, one of the things I really love about the DMG2 are the terrain powers that they have in there. And I've been using a lot of terrain powers in my own campaign, and one of the terrain powers you might have for that is an ability for a player to collapse the platform, maybe three you know, 3 athletics checks to bash it down so that it collapses and does a bunch of damage to the seer and ruins their perch.
Yeah, very cool.
You can kind of mix it. It's terrain that's really beneficial to the monster that actually can be turned around and turned to, you know, turn into a pretty bad detriment mm-hmm. for them.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. That's what terrain effects is one of those things that I really, really like the idea of. Mm-hmm. And have a little bit of a hard time implementing. You know, it's a little bit like my players have been playing a video game where, and I hate to do the D&D video game comparison, but
yeah.
You know, they've been playing a game where the environment is not fully destructible.
Right.
And now suddenly DMG2 comes out and the environment has become fully destructible. You know, right. They can do things with it, but they don't realize they can do things with it. You know, so I think I need to be a little more clear at times of saying, you know, this is the situation, and look. With your perception, you notice that rock overhang does not look as stable as you think it is.
And sometimes you just have to spell it out for him. You know, it looks like if you smash this 3 times, it would collapse and do a bunch of damage to the guy that's on top.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you hate to sell it out like that, but sometimes they won't do it otherwise.
Well, I think what I should do is spell it out, you know, for a few sessions.
Right.
Get them used to looking for things like that.
I can't remember which one of the Wizards of the Coast guys talked about this, but remember when they had that hotline while ago?
Yeah.
One of the things that the guy I talked to on the hotline mentioned, it might have been Chris Tulak, was that you should actually make – or, you know, you should consider making terrain effects triggerable with a minor action rather than a standard action. Because a lot of players will not – they don't know what a terrain power is going to do, but they know what their powers are going to do. Right. So they're not going to go for a terrain power because it's like – it's probably not going to do that much damage compared to my – you know, big encounter power.
Well, that's
but if they can do it as a minor, then they'll go ahead and risk it because they're not losing much.
Right, and that's funny because as you were talking about your idea for that rock overhang, I had the same sort of thought, is that if I make that even a move action, to make an athletics check to sort of kick it or whatever, you know, that's a little more enticing because you can do that and still take a swing at whatever.
Yeah, I've started doing that pretty much with all of the skill challenges, unless it's something really major. All of the skill challenges that happen during combat, I usually allow a minor action to trigger that challenge so that players don't feel like they're losing a standard action to do something. And then you can also limit it so that it's a minor action to do it, but it's only one per round, so they can't do like 3 minor actions and completely blow the skill challenge away in one round.
Cool. All right. Any other thoughts on building our foul spawn, fey gate encounter?
The only thing, I mean, as far as the encounter you designed, the only thing I would probably change is, it just depends on how nasty to your players you want to be. Mm-hmm. My players just, you know, they're really good and they've been playing a long time, so they blaze through a lot of the battles I throw their way. So I try to be as mean as possible.
Sure.
And the mean thing to do in this encounter would be to replace those Grues and maybe the Berserkers with all Manglers. And that sheer number of attacks you're going to be able to inflict upon them with the Mangler, the Seers, and the Tiger would be great. The other thing that I like about the Tiger is almost you almost might think of the Tiger as an environmental effect more so than a creature, in that perhaps the party using nature checks could convince the Tiger to attack the foul spawn, and the foul spawn might have some way to counteract that to get the Tiger to attack the players. So what you have is this creature that can continually bounce back and forth on whether or not it's attacking the foul spawn or attacking the players.
Uh-huh.
And you know, kind of like Pong with a big Tiger instead of a ball.
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking about tactics on how I could use that Tiger as you were talking, and I guess my thought is that the Tiger is going to just sort of attack whoever's closest.
Sure,
and
sure.
So the foul spawn's response is just get the heck away from it and keep attacking the party.
Right.
You know, and so it becomes this you know, pinball bouncing around the battlefield, and the foul spawn are trying to use it to manipulate things to get it to attack the party, and the party obviously is going to do vice versa.
Right. Yeah, but it might add a little bit more strategy to the battle if the players feel like they can actually do stuff with the Tiger.
Or even if you put a sort of a short or minor sort of skill challenge element in there, you know,
where
they're making
right.
nature checks to manipulate it and what have you.
Right, right. And maybe the seers are using their intelligence to, you know, scream at it in some foul language, and it turns around and attacks the players again.
Yeah.
Something like that. So that would add a lot of – I mean, between that, the collapsible platforms, the combination of seers and manglers, you know, you have a lot of – and, you know, if you used any chaos breath in there, you know, that's a pretty rich encounter. You know, there's a lot to do in that.
That's a pretty big and crazy encounter. Good.
You might make that like a double encounter, you know, throw a few more guys out there and turn into a double length encounter. Just so you don't waste all of that stuff.
Well, see, that's part of the thing. You know, your players are blazing through your encounters. My players tend to just barely scrape through most of my
encounters. Really? Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think you might find that change now that they've hit Paragon.
Well, we've been playing sort of a separate campaign in the shared world in a short hiatus of my campaign, and we've been Paragon tier, and it's been more or less the same. We tend to scrape through every encounter by the skin of our teeth. I mean, we have very little death,
right?
But we're not blazing through very. And part of the issue, I think, is both myself and the other DM tend to build encounters sort of in that hard range a lot more often than anything else.
Sure,
because there's a lot more cool stuff you can pull out that way.
Yeah.
You know, for a while, for several levels in heroic tier, I was averaging 3 encounters between levels.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Which means every encounter was the boss fight, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, normally, I think it's supposed to be about 8, isn't it?
It's 6 to 8.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
That's about what our range is. It's been about 8 to 10, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe a little less.
So, yeah, I mean, they were scraping by for a while.
Right. Yeah, that trick with the creatures that have bonuses when they have combat advantage and creatures that create those situations for combat advantage is really one of the best ways to optimize monsters for a fight.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of ones. And the hard part to remember is that it doesn't always, you know, flanking is not the only way to get combat advantage. That, you know, dazing and, I believe, weakening – and, you know, there's a bunch of different status effects. Blind, of course, can create situations where players are granting combat advantage to their enemies. Mm-hmm. You know, it works really well with ghouls, too. I think ghouls, it's all about immobilizing. And, you know, if you can create situations or environments where people become immobilized, well, then ghouls will get a whole bunch of extra damage on them.
So
that is
important to remember because it's always – it's always kind of tricky. Every, you know, I'll have an encounter where I'll have a creature with a bonus if they have combat advantage, but there won't be any particular thing to complement.
No advantage for that. Yeah.
You know, and so every now and then they'll get flanking and they'll get that, and then half the time I'll forget it because it's so rare that it even comes up.
Sure.
But with a build like this, you've got the seer specifically designed to daze, which is honestly a bit of a nasty enough power on
itself. Well, and it's a little constructed. I was like, oh wow, look at these guys; they work perfectly together.
Yeah,
but I mean, they are the same race, so it's not completely out of whack.
It totally makes sense.
Yeah,
very good. So there is a couple of different versions and some ideas on putting together creatures, specifically foul spawn, to tear your party in half.
Yeah, that's a pretty good encounter. I might have to use that one.
Yeah. Good. All right, so our second topic then is inspired by the DMG2.
Yep.
Which I find a lot of things that I do anymore in my campaign to be inspired by what's in DMG2.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fantastic, excellent book in terms of advice and things to make you think about improving your game. And the first chapter of that book talks about collaborative storytelling.
Right.
And so that's where we sort of decided to go with our advice topic, because that helps us sort of bring together both a topic that's relevant to DMs and a topic that's relevant to players. So if you're only a player out there, like I suppose most of the D&D community is, this gives you some ideas on how to work with your campaign and work with your DM.
Right.
So, Mike, what is collaborative storytelling?
Well, the idea of collaborative storytelling, the interesting thing for me is, I mean, I've been a DM, I think, since I was 14. And this probably speaks poorly of me, but I hadn't even really thought about this concept until I picked up the DMG2 and read it. And then I read it and I was like, wait a minute. So that means that players can start to add story elements to your game that aren't just focused around their character? And then I kind of sat and thought about that for a little bit. That's actually a pretty cool idea. Well, and apparently in a lot of other RPGs and a lot of other DMs have been doing this already. That, you know, when you sit down at a table, the traditional way is, as a dungeon master, I develop a story, and then all of the players pick their player character, and the only interaction that the player has with the story is through their character, not through anything else. And what this is saying is, no, you know, relax a little bit and let each of the players start to build their own piece of the world as well that goes beyond their character. And I think it's a great idea, and it's actually a little hard to do, which is why I thought it might be something that'd be interesting to talk about. Because it's, you know, as a DM, it's hard to let go and give that level of control to players. And as a player, it's hard to step outside of the character and start to say, you know, I can actually talk about what this bar is like.
Right.
Other than just my guy being there.
Well, and it's a pretty careful balance, because as a DM, there are certain elements that I need to be true, you know,
right,
in my world in order to tell the story.
Right.
And a lot of DMs, I think, because of that, are resistant to give up too much control of the world to their players.
Right.
And,
right,
you know, what if a player says that there's a certain thing or whatever in that bar and you need it to not be there?
Right.
Then you've got to mention that, no, you can't do that. And that gives away maybe one of the mysteries, you know.
Sure.
You've ruined the suspense.
Well, that right there is a really interesting way about how to think about running a game and how to think about developing the story for your game. I'm going to pitch another book that I think is probably one of the best books on storytelling, or best books on writing, actually called On Writing by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he talks about the difference between plot-driven stories and character-driven stories. Mm-hmm. I don't think he refers to it like that, but that's essentially what he's talking about. And in a plot-driven story, you know where the ending is going to be. You kind of know what the major steps are to get there. You could outline the whole campaign and know how you're going to get from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And in a character-driven story, you have no idea where the end is going to be. And the characters and their actions kind of drive the way the story is going to go. So the way I like to think of it is kind of like a pool table. That, you know, if each character is a ball on a pool table, when you throw one character and it collides into a whole bunch of other characters and those collide into other characters and so on, you have no idea where it's necessarily going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really hard to do. It's hard to let go to that point, to let a campaign kind of go in any direction that it can go. But sometimes the reward, you know, the reward can be great. Now, you still have to have some kind of structure. I mean, there's still a pool table and it still has, you know, bumpers. So you can still kind of say, okay, well, I still know where it's generally going to go. I know what the general theme is going to be. But I'm going to let the characters kind of drive where things go. And what's interesting from a DM is that can actually be pretty interesting as a dungeon master to watch how the story evolves outside of your control. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I have, as a DM, I struggle a little. I try to find a pretty decent middle ground.
Right.
You know, I have an idea of where my story is going, or at least I have an idea of events that are happening in my world, which is really – it's character-driven but not characters controlled by the PCs.
Right.
You know, so I know what the NPCs in the world are doing and what they're up to. And then
yeah, that's
and,
actually –
you know,
yeah,
and then it's the PCs that sort of interact with that, and how that they interact with that can largely be driven by them.
Right.
Now, sometimes I've got to throw down the tracks and get them on you know,
sure,
get them on the railroad.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah, I love that feeling where you sit down at the table and you say, okay, you're in this environment. What would you like to do? And you look around and you see just, you know, a bunch of blank faces that are all staring at you like, I don't know.
Well,
you know, where do you want us to go? And you're like, okay, encounter one.
I had a situation at the end of the heroic tier of my campaign where I wanted to end the heroic tier on a high note, and I knew what that high note was.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get them there. And they were sort of debating as to whether or not they were going to go there or not. And so I threw in – I kept throwing in just a little bit more manipulation, you know.
Sure, yeah.
This person happens to be over there. Oh, this is all these people want you to go, you know. And
there's a great big pot of gold over there.
Eventually they made the decision to go there, and then after the, after the session, like, wow, you really threw down the tracks on that railroad, didn't you?
Right, like, right. Wow. Yeah, I have the disadvantage that I lay out my encounters. I don't use a draw map or anything. I use Dwarvenforge, so I have to build it all out before they come over. So that means they know there's two encounters, and they know that they're already pretty predetermined.
Right.
So, well,
and,
you know.
And that's the other thing is that as a DM, I need time to prep. And
right.
So if I don't know where they're going
right.
or what they're doing when the session starts, I don't know how to run that game.
Right.
You know?
So here's yeah.
– Go ahead.
But here, there's one, you know, I'm all about the practical tips, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the practical tips I like in this is to do that kind of collaborative storytelling outside of the game in email or in some other platform. So, you know, I run a weekly game, so during the week we can have different storytelling elements. And they could even be storytelling elements between me and one other player that kind of helps evolve the game. And I can use that to kind of prep the next game. So when we actually sit down at the table and start rolling dice, we know what we're all doing. But between the week, between the sessions, we can use email to kind of, yeah. you know, let the story evolve as a group. And that can actually work pretty well.
And
I actually was doing that earlier tonight.
That can work really well, although I do have two or three players that aren't regularly online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard enough for them to even know whether or not we're gaming this weekend because we keep track of all that on the wiki, you know, and
they
don't get online so they can't check the wiki, and sometimes
sure.
they show up at my door and it's like, oh yeah, we're not playing today, you know.
Sure. Right.
So I mean, yeah, I mean that's great advice if all of your players can handle that.
Right. And I find email work seems to work best for everybody for us. We keep sure. a wiki as well. We use Obsidian Portal. But I use that kind of to just generally track the game, but we use email for all the decisions.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And yeah, if you can pull that off with your group, then I think that's good advice. On the other hand, that's also – you don't want to do all the role-playing between sessions.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
It
sure.
is a role-playing game, and I think there's some,
right.
some element of fun comes into the game when you're face-to-face
right.
and
right.
discussing something and acting something out or making some decisions. So.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a balance in this whole thing, in this whole conversation. I think it's all about a matter of figuring out where the balance is, and I think – as a DM, maybe what I need to do anyway is let go of some of that control a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like the conversation we had about the terrain effects, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where my players don't know how much control I'm willing to give them.
Right.
And so they just don't push it. They don't ask.
Right.
You know, and so
right.
what I need to do is figure out how to let them know that it's okay for them to say, you know, oh, while you're in this tavern, oh, there's mm-hmm. there's my favorite Uncle Jim. I happen to, you know, or whatever it is.
Sure.
And let them know that it's okay for them to bring
sure.
those elements into the game.
Sure. And I think that one of the other things that I've started doing is a lot of times a player will say something like, well, what kind of weapon is in that pile of treasure? And I'll say, well, you tell me what kind of weapon is in that pile of treasure and how did it get there and what's it called and what's its little story, you know, and then they usually stare at me for a while and then grab the adventurer's vault and start looking. But there's, you know, there's a lot of time kind of churning the questions back on people when they say, well, what does this guy look like? You can say, well, what do you think he looks like? And he says, well, I think he's a great big fat guy with a wart on his nose. Then that can kind of start to get players to realize they have this level of control.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the easiest places to do it are like loot. You know, loot is one of them where I've as, you know, as a DM, I've basically given up on trying to keep track of loot and trying to keep track of players' abilities because there's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do loot. And one of the ways that I wouldn't recommend to use all the time is to let players generally select what loot showed up.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say, well, there's a weapon in the treasure or he's holding an axe, but the player gets to choose what kind of axe it was.
Sure.
And that way the player has a, you know, immediate interest in actually doing that little bit of storytelling to determine what kind of axe yeah. it was.
Well,
because they get to pick the axe.
And there are times if you can find a time in story where that makes a lot of sense, you
mm-hmm.
know, like in the campaign that I'm playing and not running, but playing, that recently happened where the DM basically said, well, you're going off on a mission for the crown. The crown, and it's a matter of life or death for the empire. So whatever you need is at your disposal. So make your wish list, and as long as it's within reason, you can get it. You
know, right.
Sort of, that sort of thing. And so that's – we caught up on about 3 or 4 levels worth of loot, mm-hmm. you know, in one big shebang.
Sure. Sure. I think there's a couple areas that also kind of lend themselves to this group storytelling. That's certainly in building out the headquarters for your PCs.
Oh yeah.
You know, if the PCs have an area that they're kind of developing, that's their home base. Maybe they own, you know, in my campaign, they own a shop, and they can tell me about what's going on in the shop and who they've hired to maintain it, and you know, if they've done any remodeling to it, or even if they have a little home base of a town. You know, maybe they're the ones to determine how that town is going to be built out.
Yeah.
Not to tie it too much to video games, but I just finished Assassin's Creed 2, and in that one, you can actually build out your home base. You know, you have this villa, and you can decide what paintings to put in the villa, and what, you know, if you're going to let your brothel grow, or you know, have your miners mine more. And I thought that was pretty interesting for an action game.
It's like all those cutesy little Facebook games.
Yeah, right. Oh, God. No, don't get me started on those. So
it's D&D Farmville.
Farmville. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. My wife will certainly like it.
Oh, good.
The other thing I was thinking about is I had the opportunity a while ago when I was playing at a RPGA game locally here at the Game Parlor in Chantilly. And there was I think it was like a 10-year-old, 10 or 12-year-old kid who was playing with us, and we all kind of rolled our eyes because, like, oh, great, we have to play with a 10 or 12-year-old kid. And one thing that I kind of noticed with him is he had far more imagination about what the place actually looked like than any of us that were sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all looking at our character sheets, and we're thinking about what kind of stats that monster has and trying to calculate its AC based on how much we missed by. But the kid was saying things like, well, I want to fire my beams into that crystal thing over there because maybe it'll actually do more. And I think we all kind of just, you know, pointed at a sheet and said, just play like you're supposed to be playing. But I thought about it later, and it was like, you know, I wish I'd thought about that, you know, or the DM should have said, you know, actually that will work, and you can fire it into the crystals, and it actually, you know, turns it into a burst 5 instead of a direct shot, you know, once, because then the crystals explode.
Well, yeah. And that's exactly one of those sort of situations where I wish my players could bring, and myself as well, could bring that attitude more to the game.
Right.
And say,
right.
Sometimes you just need to forget the rules.
Exactly.
And say, here's the world. Yeah. What can I try to do?
Right.
You know, and,
right.
And I think a good DM will look at that and say, okay, I'm going to reward you for being creative and coming up with new
exactly.
solutions to your problem.
Right, right. And yeah, that kind of, I think that return to a childlike look, you know, trying to remember things. I'm reading a book about drawing, and it always talks about how do you have to remember what drawing was like as a kid compared to drawing today. And, you know, thinking about a D&D game like a kid again can kind of open up a lot of those possibilities. Mm-hmm. And if we can get our players to do it more, you know, and if there are players that are listening to this, you know, they should work with their DM to kind of come up with a lot more open opportunities for this kind of group storytelling, which could be really hard because a lot of DMs, I mean, you know, myself included, are kind of control freaks. And the last thing we want is like people mucking around in our cool story that we've spent all this time kind of putting together. But a couple of times where I've had, there's one particular player in my group who twice has surprised me with a little bit of this group storytelling and said, well, what if it was this guy? And I went, oh my God, really? That's a great idea. And it was, you know, and it turned out to be these wonderful shifts in the story, you know, players that we thought were dead that came back and all sorts of stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm.
That I had no plan for, and it didn't, it worked out great. You know, it meant that the story became a lot more exciting for me because it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't like I know exactly where the story is going to go at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's cool. I struggle with that as a DM a little bit, but I'm going to make it my mission in the next time my players walk into a tavern, mm-hmm. I'm going to describe the setting. And when they ask me who's in it, I'm going to tell them to describe to me who they think should be in it.
There's a guy that wants to give me a great big sword over there.
Yes, sir.
This thing you have to worry about, right? There's a guy with a big sack of gold for me.
Well, and see, my players, I'm so not worried about them going there. My group, and it's so my fault because I'm this way too,
mm-hmm.
But my group tends to go more of the goofy silly.
Sure.
Which totally takes you out of the story, but it's a great time for that night. Yeah. You know?
So. I think if you know, God help me not to look at World of Warcraft as similar to 4E. But if Warcraft taught us anything, it taught us that, you know, a little bit of humor can still work really well in a fantasy RPG and not lose the fantasy element.
Yeah.
It's always good for a laugh.
An example of the level of goofiness of our group. In the campaign that I'm currently playing in, we have an embassy within the city, and we have a couple of Warforged servants, and one of them has sort of become the go-to Warforged to bring us tea.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we want tea, this Warforged brings us tea. Well, one of the players recently had a character change, got rid of the old character, died, and decided to replace him with one of the Warforged that's been our servant all along.
Sure, yeah.
And we all decided that it was the one that's been getting us tea and that he has a spigot in his chest where he can continuously pour out tea. And in fact, we've all named him Mr. Tea. Which the DM hates. You know?
Sure,
But we just can't let it go. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's another one, right? Where you always have the characters that want to have funny names for their characters and funny stuff. And I think any of us who take our hobby seriously immediately go, "Ah,
well, and
are you really going to name your character Big Bird? Are you kidding?" and then you know you go, "Hey, you know, whatever, sure."
Well, right,
Big Bird it is.
And I struggle to sort of let it go as well because the guy who is currently the DM, when he was a player and when I'm running. It always talks about wanting to bring in an Ape Lord, which is a race from One Bad Egg, the now gone PDF 4th edition publisher, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make an Ape Lord named Cornelius, which just drove me nuts. And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. He kept talking about doing it. You know, and ultimately, I think I've gotten to a point where it's like, okay, if you get to a point where your character dies and you want to make the Ape Lord –
yeah.
As long as you can give me the story as to why this makes sense in the Forgotten Realms, where there are no ape people,
right.
You know, then I will so go with it. And just, you know,
right.
I'll make that part of my world, which is part of the collaborative storytelling concept.
Yeah, right.
Take the player's ideas, even if it's a little bit goofy or not what you thought you wanted your world to be, and figure out a way to make it make sense so that you can say yes.
Yeah. Well, it's that hard part of kind of remembering that it's not necessarily your world at that point, but it's our world.
Right.
You know, and that's the hard thing for us to kind of step out of and get into. But when it does, it really works well. It's a lot of fun.
Well, and when it is our world and the players see it as our world,
mm-hmm.
then when you tell the stories you want to tell,
mm-hmm.
they're all the more affected by it, you know? I find that if I'm running a campaign and I keep everything pretty tightly on the tracks,
mm-hmm.
then I don't get as much bang for my buck. You know, they're not as invested into the world. And so when this mind-blowing, earth-shattering thing happens, they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, it doesn't really hit them.
Right.
You know,
right.
But if they're invested into the world because it's their world too, they helped build it.
Right.
Then I can still tell my stories, and it has more oomph. It has more meaning.
Sure, sure. So yeah, I think the practical tips to get people started in something like this is to start small. You know, start by saying, okay, well, you found a magic sword. What's it called, and how did it get there? You know, going to the bar, you know, that you mentioned, you go into a bar, you tell me who's here, you mm-hmm. know, what is the barmaid like, and then kind of expanding. And I think there probably is a limit because eventually it's just, you know. I mean, at what point do we step away from the table and go play Xbox while they're running the game?
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think there's a lot of potential for players to be more involved in building out the world and deciding how things got to where they got.
Yeah. Well, I'm so going to do that. Next time I give out some magical item and they do a history check to find out more about it, I'm going to say, okay, you made your check. Now go ahead and write that history.
Right.
You tell me what it is.
And yeah, I don't know. I mean, my players probably need a little bit more motivation to do some homework. But you know, if you say, well, you'll get, you know, bonus gold or bonus experience points or whatever if you do a little write up, so that, you know, there's a little paragraph that kind of describes this is the item and this is where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
Then it kind of makes everything a little rich. They get a little bonus for having done that write up, and the story gets a little fuller.
Very cool. All right. Any last thoughts on our storytelling? I think we've sort of gone left, right, and all over the place on the conversation, but I think there's been some good information in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good section of the DMG to read over a couple of times. And I think there's a lot of sections that are probably like that, yeah. But it's one where, you know, kind of saying, okay, well, like this week, how am I going to use this idea? You know, what element of the story can I let the players kind of dive into? And just, you know, finding those opportunities, you know, one quick story I'll share is, you know, PCs were going through a dungeon. They found a dwarf that was being held captive, and this was in running one of the published modules, and the dwarf in the published module was just some random dwarf that had been grabbed up. And so I said, yeah, so there's a dwarf in a cage, and one of the players said, oh, is that Oswald? And Oswald was a previous character that had disappeared for a long time. Oh. And I looked at her and I said, yes, it is, you know, and suddenly the whole thing changed. And, yeah, you know, it was just a radical shift. So finding those, and I, you know, it was one of those quick decisions where when she asked if it was Oswald, I could have said, no, it's just some random dwarf that's in this module. You know, I said, no, actually, yes, it is. So finding that opportunity and when they come up, you know, because we're control freaks, our instinct is to say no, because we think it's not. But when you hear an opportunity like that coming up, think about it and think about whether or not you can jump with that. And you know, if you don't think of any reason why that would completely hose your story, go ahead and go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, see, I always struggle because when you start doing things like that, when there's that many big coincidences running around your story, it mm-hmm. always feels a little soap opera like.
Well,
you know?
it does. But if it's the player coming up with it, then it's not.
Well, and I think
they're not going to complain.
and I think I even heard somebody possibly on Twitter recently give the advice of don't be afraid of the soap opera effect. You know, it's a game and it's a fantasy.
Right,
and
right.
You know what? Let every coincidence possible happen, and all of the main players of your life be major players in the world shaking events, and that's fine. Let it happen.
Doesn't have to be Gone with the Wind. Go ahead and be Roadhouse once in a while.
Yeah, and that's all right.
All right.
Okay, so I think I could summarize what we discussed today as when you're thinking about building encounters, if you've got a creature that gets a bonus damage with combat advantage, find another creature that can give that combat advantage, like our Foulspawn Mangler and Foulspawn Seer combination.
Right.
Also, we talked about using different terrain effects and environmental effects to sort of add elements of interest to your encounter.
Yep.
And then we finished off by basically reiterating the constant sort of mantra of DMing these days of find a way to say yes, you know.
Yeah,
give the player some control over the world, and sometimes don't just say yes. Encourage your players to actually come up with stuff on their own, and force yourself to give up control. So when they say, "How did this magic item get here?" you have them come up with it. When they say, "Who's in the tavern?" have them decide who's in the tavern.
Right.
Does that sort of summarize what we talked about?
Yep.
All right. Then that is episode 124. I want to start off by thanking NobleKnight.com, our sponsor of the episode. And I want to thank Mr. Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com. Thank you for being on the show again.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a joy.
SlyFlourish.com and 4eblogs.com.
Right.
Does that handle it?
Yeah, yeah. And Twitter.com/SlyFlourish.
And Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. I will make a conscious effort to remember to link all of those things in the show notes.
Oh, great.
All right. In conclusion then, you can always feel free to email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can also follow me personally on Twitter. I'm twitter.com/squatch, SQUACH. You can always help out the show by reviewing it on iTunes or other places and letting people know about it. Word of mouth still seems to be the best way possible to let people out there know that the show exists. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store. If anything you buy there helps the show make some money and stay on the air and helps us pay our bills. And in fact, if you get to Amazon.com through the Tomes website, I will get credit for whatever it is you buy. I've had people buy a new vacuum cleaner and I got a cut of that as well. So what we all know that you're going to be buying something on Amazon soon anyway. Why not help pay our bills along the way? And links for anything mentioned in the show will be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This is the part of the show where I usually, or at least recently, have been trying to have a witty conclusion, tying us back to the witty introduction. And since we're unscripted today, I don't have one. So, this has been episode 124 with Mike Shea, building an encounter and talking about collaborative storytelling of...
I'm on the wall.